Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the We Put the Hospital in Hospitality Show. That is right. We are saluting the airline industry.
Let's and drag you out of here.
Just in time for our summer travels. Have a couple of remarks to make before we get the show going. You know, I might as well go ahead and do that. Let me just go ahead before anything else happens.
Shelly and I will just sit here like rubber chickens.
Let me, I want to apologize to our radio fans about what happened last week on Health Matters. After our show started, we were approached by some crew members who said they needed the studio, and we of course sought volunteers, and then we followed our involuntary denial of co-host process. Now that involves offering up to $1,000 in compensation. We approached one of our co-hosts to explain apologetically that she was being denied seating. She raised her voice and refused to comply.
Apologetically?
With crew member instruction. She was approached a few more times. Each time she refused and became more and more disruptive and belligerent.
At what point did you get the station manager?
I still don't have my $1,000.
Our producers were left with no choice but to call the WMKY security officers to assist in removing the co-host from the show. She repeatedly declined to leave. While I deeply regret this situation arose, I emphatically stand behind Health Matters and want to commend you, our listeners, for continuing to go above and beyond to ensure we broadcast right. I do believe there are lessons we can learn from this experience, and we're taking a close look at the circumstances surrounding this incident. Treating our co-host and each other with respect and dignity is the core of who we are, and we must always remember this, no matter how challenging the situation. That is, I copied the words of the CEO of United Airlines.
And I'm pretty glad.
It was a good speech.
I'm pretty glad that you're the CEO of Health Matters.
Well, you know, every once in a while the show gets out of hand.
Every once in a while?
Yeah.
Give us credit, man.
Okay. Well, let's get the show
started. Even though nobody knows who we are.
Thanks to our listeners of True Talk Internet Radio, and to introduce our co-medical host, and this time claiming a seat with no competition whatsoever from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program Assistant Professor Shelly Irving. Welcome back, Shelly.
I am buckled in this time.
You look good.
Just try to remove me.
And also, the man who sat idly on the sidelines and let the whole thing happen.
No, I filmed it.
Thank you very much for that. UK Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. To tell you how to access us on the internet, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know you can get the audio of the show. To get the audio of the show, go to WMKY.org. That's Morehead State Public Radio's website. That's where we keep the Health Matters archive of audio. We keep the most recent shows there. Again, there's a little summary in case you're looking for a particular show. Certainly, there's a link there. You can download the audio. It's MP3 format. There's a podcast link in case you want to have it delivered, as I like to say, auto-magically, about 4 days after the show airs the first time. Certainly do that. If you know what a podcast is, then you certainly know what to do. After that, you've gotten so upset that you just have to say something. The place you say it is facebook.com/HM Radio Show. That is our fan page. And yes, Tony likes it to be called a fan page because Tony's all about the fans. Aren't you, Tony?
Oh, well, yes. I think we owe
public
them.
Public perception. That's
some
Tony.
Kind of an explanation. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we, you know, when the wheels fall off, this is where we get the lug wrench to put them back on. Certainly go to facebook.com/HM Radio Show and like us, and I mean that in the Facebook sort of way. I mean, the other liking is totally up to you. Leave us some feedback. Let us know what's good about the show. Let us know what's a topic you'd like to hear about, or maybe there's a topic you don't want to hear any more of. I don't know, Tony. Do you think we have a topic that people don't want to hear of anymore?
You.
Can I vote pharmaceuticals? I'm not a topic. I'm an issue. So there's a big difference. So anyway, the idea is you know, Facebook.com, that's the place where you interact with Health Matters. And surprisingly, unlike those big radio shows, we actually attend to our Facebook followers directly. You get direct interaction with the staff. We certainly encourage you to do so. Again, that's Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Melanoma, and their motto, Learn, Don't Burn. You need to know something about melanoma. We lose about 136 people in Kentucky every year.
Do we ever find them?
This is not funny, man.
Hey, you didn't.
I know. You were just sailing along, weren't you? And then I started talking about people dying.
Well, why do you do that with the sponsor? The sponsor's supposed to be fun and energetic.
Well, we're trying to avoid dying. That should be pretty energetic. 136 people. Now, here's the interesting thing. Melanoma is an odd condition. It does appear to be related to blistering sunburns young at life. That is, total sun exposure, yeah, to some degree, but sunburns really accelerate this process.
Is this a correlation or is this actual? I mean, we got direct linkage to this.
Yeah, what happens when you sunburn is you damage your skin. The skin can't quite repair that damage. There are some DNA breakages that leads to the development of the melanoma. Now, you look at your top 10 highest incidence states, the ones who have the most cases of melanoma. You start off with Washington, Montana, Idaho, New Hampshire, Iowa, Minnesota, Oregon, Delaware, Vermont, and the number one state in the nation for melanoma is Utah.
So now, that's an interesting mix of states.
It is.
There seems to be some kind of a longitudinal line that's separating them from the South.
Yeah, the southern states, Arizona,
Florida.
Texas, Florida, the Sunshine State. Sunshine State, by the way, is not an easy thing to say on the radio. I'll just point that out. But at any rate,
noted.
These states, you know what they said? I was looking. I have long puzzled over why these northern states seem to have the highest incidence rates. The interesting thing there is that's where the white people live.
You think so?
Yes.
They have the highest percentage of white people. It doesn't have anything to do with elevation. You don't think that those places are generally closer to the sun?
Minnesota's number five. Iowa's number six.
But I know when
shoot your theory down.
When you get above that plateau out west, you get up about a mile high. You know, and Tony, I'm just saying anecdotally. I lived in Denver for over two periods of time in total of about almost 18 months, and it absolutely ruined one of my vehicles because I didn't keep the clear coat nice and waxed. And it absolutely ate the clear coat. The sun ate the clear coat off my car. And so it made me wonder, but I was a mile high up. You know, I was a higher elevation than I was in Kentucky, you know, by some 4,700 feet. So I just wonder if this is altitude-based.
Maybe.
Anyway, possibly. That sounds more educated than your theory.
No, I read this. I didn't actually make this up.
Dang it. I can't win today.
The percentages are higher.
What about sunblock usage?
Well, there may be some, you know, obviously these may be the people that go to Florida and Texas to get the sunshine, and they get burned. Again, it's burned, not the day-to-day stuff that is the problem. Kentucky ranked 13th, West Virginia 35th. Remember that ranking because I'm going to tell you the mortality rates. Where do people die from melanoma? Number 10, Maine. Number 9, Indiana. 8, Colorado. 7, Tennessee. Kentucky is 6th in the nation with our 136 deaths of melanoma. And one of the problems is, this is the most common cancer among young women. The people that are dying with a lot of life left, dying of melanoma. Number 5, Kansas. Number 4, Nebraska. Number 3, Utah. Number 2, West Virginia. 35 in incidence, 2 in death rate. That is a bad healthcare system right there. I mean, that's the evidence of it. And Idaho, ranking number 6 in incidence, is the top-ranked state in the nation for melanoma mortality. We'll talk more about what you can do to avoid melanoma in our second fractional portion. That's our sponsor, Melanoma. Learn, don't burn. I thought since we were talking about airlines, and I think everyone is aware of one of our own, Dr. David Dow of Louisville, was forcibly removed from a plane and started kind of a downward spiral of public relations fiascos for United Airlines. I read, essentially changing only a few words, I read the initial response from their CEO a moment ago at the start of the third fractional portion. Just to keep everybody hanging on, I will read the second statement from the CEO of United Airlines, and you can see there has been somewhat of a change. But I thought, since it's an irritating show anyway, I mean, just on a daily basis, I thought I would stick in some irritating research, and I found it, Rick. This came out of Harvard, as most irritating research does, Harvard or Duke. And this is in Appetite. It's online right now. It'll be printed in the June issue of the journal Appetite. And they were asking people how much salt they ate at a restaurant. So they collected meal receipts and they gave out questionnaires back in 2013, 2014. Nearly 1,000 adults visited fast food restaurants and they asked them to estimate the amount of sodium. And you can imagine that. I mean, think about it. They had adults and they also had kids, adolescents. And you can just see the researchers, right? Hey, kid. Yeah, you. Come here. Do you know how much sodium you ate? Huh? Do you know? I mean, the idea of waylaying people as they come out of a fast food restaurant.
You mean they didn't just stand on the street corner and hold up signs?
No. This is their methods, word for word here. Restaurants for the study were located in 4 New England cities. Restaurant chains with the highest U.S. sales and at least 2 locations in the city were selected. That's McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Subway for the adults. Dunkin' Donuts substituted for KFC for the kids. Apparently, kids don't go to KFC anymore. Who knew? They said street intercept survey methodology. How about that? There's one now. Let's go get him. It was used to collect data from participants outside the restaurant entrances or if the assistants were not permitted to work on the restaurant's property on a public sidewalk adjacent to the restaurant. They approached diners who appeared eligible based on age for the samples and asked them to save their receipts if they were interested in a study. When they exited the restaurant, they collected the receipts, asked them to identify items, guess how much salt they had eaten, and fill out a questionnaire. And then they got a $2 gift card. A $2 gift card.
For where?
Probably McDonald's.
Well, sure. Whatever
that's
restaurant
ironic.
You stayed at, right? But you think
about
it. I
mean, that's more research for them.
Yeah, but you think about it. How annoying would that be? You come out. I mean, why do you go to a fast food place? Because you're in a hurry. So you come out, and here's this street intercept guy wanting to know how much, if you can guess how much salt you ate. And the answer is they were terrible at guessing. First of all, at these fast food restaurants, the average sodium they took in was nearly 1,300 milligrams for adults and 1,200 for adolescents.
So I would assume this is something that a McDonald's or a big chain probably wouldn't want to just blindly participate in a study like this. They don't want to know.
They threw them out.
Right. Because, I mean, it would be the far better way to do this is obviously take your receipts, decipher them by, you know, average them up and put it, and you could probably mathematically come up with a salt per customer number, but I'm sure they're not willing.
Right. 10% of the participants purchased meals with more than 2,300 milligrams of sodium.
Is that a lot?
Yeah, the American Heart Association says you ought to get 1,500 milligrams in the entire day. Mm-hmm. We'll usually talk about 2,000 milligrams as a pretty, that's about, the average is closer to 3,000. But when we're talking about a healthy diet, we're looking at 2,000.
How about you when you're eating watermelon?
I used to frost, you know that. I used to frost my watermelon. I don't put any salt on watermelon anymore. It's tough, but, you know, you retrain your taste buds.
Would you get tired of being called old salty?
Well, I just, you know, I just realized how much salt I was using. And we get plenty of salt. Like I said, average is
over 3,000 milligrams. Did somebody
intercept you? Oh, no, I didn't get intercepted, thank you very much. But I have changed my ways with salt. I'm not sure we all need to be under 1,500 milligrams. But 2,300 milligrams at one meal at McDonald's.
Well, the thing is the guarantee of the calorie count on that is also well above what the national average says you should have per meal.
Yeah, the adults underestimated their sodium by about 1,000 milligrams, and the kids by 900. So they have no idea what they're eating. Meanwhile, you have no idea what you're listening to. So we're going to take a break and let you re-equilibrate. We're going to come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the We Put the Hospital in Hospitality Show, our salute to United Airlines and their customer service division. Our sponsor for the second time, Melanoma. Remember, learn, don't burn. That's their motto. We talked about Kentucky at about 136 deaths per year, has the sixth highest rate of melanoma death. It is a death rate that is the sixth highest in the nation. Number one is Idaho. Number two is West Virginia. Our incidence rates, the chances of getting melanoma, we are 13th. West Virginia is 35th. So, again, we do not have a good system of care for skin diseases. And anybody that works in medicine in the state of Kentucky is aware of the fact that we do not have a very good system for taking care of people's skin. Back in 2014, Brigham and Women's Hospital looked at 100,000 nurses participating in the Nurses' Health Study 2. Between 25 and 42 years, they were followed for 20 years between 1989 and 2009. The risk of skin cancer was 68% higher and 80% higher for melanoma in women who reported 5 or more blistering sunburns between ages 15 and 25. That is, while you are a teenager, you are setting your risk for melanoma. And that is why we are so, so worried about tanning beds. Because you can easily get a blistering sunburn from spending too much time in the tanning bed, and that then dogs you the rest of your life with a much higher risk of melanoma. So that's number one. You have to be sun-wise. You have to protect yourself from midday outdoor sun from tanning, from unnecessary sun exposure. We've talked a lot about getting out in the sun for vitamin D. Best to do that morning and evening, not midday. And certainly if you're going to the beach, you're going to have to take some steps to protect yourself. I remember I went to the beach, and I got extremely sunburned, probably freshman in high school, I think. We didn't use suntan lotion. That was for sissies.
Still is.
Yeah. Did you get sunburned? I mean, you grew up in Arizona.
No, I didn't. I went to high school in Arizona.
Did you get sunburned?
I was like, I'm sure I did.
Ever remember your skin peeling.
I did that last year.
Now, for our radio fans, if you look at the center of your speaker, you'll see Shelly, and she has a fair complexion, I think. Shelly, I suspect you were negligent and got badly sunburned, or you took things seriously from the start.
No, I was negligent and got badly sunburned. I still do. I usually get one good burn every year.
I was under 18. My parents were negligent.
Are you going to blame it on your parents?
Under 18, it's their responsibility.
No, I think you know what a sunburn is. It's not like, what's this? The sun has radiation.
But I wasn't responsible for my well-being.
I'm going to call your mother. I am going to call your mother, and we'll get this sorted out right now. That's ridiculous. Man, you can't blame your parents for getting a sunburn.
Why? I had no idea there was going to be long-term effects.
That's our sponsor, Melanoma. Learn, don't burn. Now, I've got a series of articles here that I'm going to go through reasonably quickly. But
going to talk about the United thing?
I'm going to do another apology in the third fractional portion, but I don't have an apology. There were only two apologies I could find on the internet. So go ahead.
Well, do you want to apologize? Who was right in that? Who was wrong in that? Tony, if you get pulled over and the cop asks you to get out of the car, you have to get out of your car. If you don't get out of your car, guess what he's going to do? He's going to drag you out of the car. At some point, there's a personal responsibility here. That man should have got up out of that seat. And I'm sorry, I'm sure that flies in the face of public opinion, but right or wrong, there comes a point in time where you have to listen to law enforcement.
Direct your comments to Rick Phillips.
Where am I wrong here? Where am I wrong? If you do that in your car with you think you weren't speeding, and the cop asks you to get out of the car, and you choose not to, the same thing's going to happen to you.
I understand. At that point, I'm breaking the law.
The minute that police officer asked him to get out, that was a sanctioned police officer from the airport security. And today, you don't mess with the TSA, guys.
I guess the problem I have is that they called him in the first place.
Okay, but that's not that's not the problem of the guy got dragged off the plane because he chose not to listen to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
I think both sides are wrong here. Bad policy, poor personal responsibility. But if a police officer asks me to do something, it's my responsibility as a good citizen to listen to law enforcement. At what point do I not get to listen to law enforcement?
That's a tough one, Rick. I will tell you, you think about road rage, where people get cut off, but they're still going to where they're going at whatever speed they're going.
But not cut off by a cop.
I know, I understand. But follow me through on this. It is getting really difficult to fly. It is getting extremely difficult to fly. The long lines, the delays. We were in Orlando. I was at an educational meeting, and we finally gave up. We drove 12 hours back to Kentucky because we knew they could not fly us out of there. It was about 15 or 18 hours later they were going to fly us to LaGuardia and try again. They were flying
from
Orlando
to LaGuardia.
I'm not
saying the airlines don't stink.
Right.
I'm not saying that they're not terrible. And that they should have better policy, and they shouldn't put cattle cars together where they're trying to load so many people that four seats are going to cause this kind of an uproar.
Agreed.
But what I'm saying is this person had he was a doctor. At some point, do I tell my daughters, by the way, you don't have to listen to law enforcement if you think you're right? At what point does he have a personal responsibility to listen to the police officer?
At what point does he have a personal responsibility to stand up for his own rights?
Okay, but is that the time to do it with a police officer standing right there on a plane?
Or it's the perfect time to do it.
Well,
people trying to intimidate and bully you and to giving up something that you paid for their convenience?
Well, it'd be different, but it was a police officer.
You are more impressed by police officers and airport authority. I'm not saying that I'm not
United
saying that
United didn't drag them off the plane.
Yeah, I understand that. The police officers dragged, the airport authority dragged the man off the plane.
I'm saying I think everybody's wrong here. The fact is if a cop tells me to pull over and I think I was doing 25 and a 25 and he tells me to get out of the car, if I choose not to get out of the car, I need to accept the consequences that are about to happen. And I'm probably going to get hit. I'm going to get pulled. I'm going to get yanked. If I push back, they're going to make sure I'm subdued. So, to me, everybody's wrong here. The airlines need to have a nice big fine for a bad policy. But you, as a human, have the right to listen to law enforcement.
You have the obligation.
You have the obligation. I'm sorry. The obligation to listen to law enforcement. At that point, the situation got elevated up and it became the personal responsibility of that person to listen to what's being told. Now, do they like what's happening? Is it bad? Is it dumb? Should they be reimbursed for the patients they didn't get to see the next day? Yes, there's a ton of things that can go on from there. But the simple fact is if law enforcement is trying to enforce what they think is something wrong, you have to take it through the process of the legal system, right? You can't just say, I don't want to.
Okay. Well, I will tell you a story. This is about, you know, Bill Walton, basketball player.
Sure.
I don't know him personally. Yeah, I understand. Coach Wooden, though, yeah. Was his coach at UCLA. And Wooden had a strict policy, no facial hair, no beards, nothing.
Right.
So Walton comes back from a break, and he's got a beard. And he goes, you know, Wooden calls him over. He says, see, you're growing a beard. And Walton says, yeah. He said, that's my right. I have the right to do that. As a college student, I can do that. And Wooden said, and you're standing up for your right. Good for you. He said, that's a good thing. I'm glad that you're standing up for your rights. You're off the team.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to exert, if you want to stand up for your rights, and there are those that would disagree with you as far as even the police force. You know, again, when you look at Black Lives Matter, that was about standing up to a police force that was overbearing. So there are those who feel that way. But I will say, you know, if you are protesting, if you are exerting those rights, then there will be consequences you have to be prepared for.
And
I'll give you that.
I think enough video has surfaced at this point, both of pre-dragging and post-dragging, to show that there was at least some attempt to be civil about asking that person to get off the plane. And this went on to the point where that person was able to make phone calls to the airline. They were over. I mean, there were minutes and minutes that went by where they had the opportunity to civilly get up and deal with their situation.
Yeah, I think they should have offered him more than $1,000. That's me.
Yeah, it all.
Oh, I think you're right. I think that's the airlines should keep offering money until, because eventually you'll buy a seat on that plane.
Right.
Yeah.
Roaring through then the health issues here. April 24th, Journal of Pediatrics, risk of child abuse deaths. More than 11,000 children from newborn to age 4 died of physical abuse in the U.S. during a 15-year study period that was reported in Pediatrics this April. The U.S. counties with the highest level of poverty, they had the highest rates of child abuse fatalities, more than 3 times greater in counties with lowest rates of poverty. Mm-hmm. Infants accounted for 20% of the children in the study, 45% of child abuse deaths. Again, 20% of the children, 45% of the child abuse deaths. Infants much more likely to die from abuse. In high poverty counties, there were almost 10 infant deaths per 100,000. That is an incredible high rate. I'm not sure why poverty, growing up among poverty, puts kids at greater risk of death. They said, I think we have to think of health. I mean, if you can't make it out of infancy, then we've got to think of ways to mitigate this. We have to find a way to protect these children. Mm-hmm. So, child abuse and poverty. Next article. Like I said, I'm moving fast here.
Sorry.
Same day, and this is in the American Medical Association Journal of Pediatrics. Dr. Yongfu Yu from Aarhus University Hospital in Denmark. I know I mispronounced something there. As many as 8% of Americans experience the death of a brother or sister in childhood. Loss of a sibling in adulthood has been linked with death of the surviving sibling. But we don't know much about what happens if you lose a sibling in childhood. So they had a Danish and Swedish national registry, 56,000 people, older than 6 months, younger than 18 years, lost a sibling. For those individuals, the risk of dying over the next 37 years, again, 6 months to 18 years, so you're looking at people that are basically less than 60 years old dying, 71% higher than for those who did not experience the death of a sibling. So what we've got then, kind of interesting, if you live in poverty, a child is more likely to die of child abuse. Mm-hmm. The siblings of that child, following the research they did in Denmark and Sweden, are going to be more likely to die because that child died. It spills over. And then, I mean, if that's not enough, a week before I just read this, wealthiest Americans live 10 to 15 years longer than the poorest. Now, I'm not saying that child abuse and that sibling death thing necessarily causes this, but you start to realize exactly how difficult it is for a person growing up in poverty. These things are set in motion before the child even reaches adulthood. Now, Rick can blame his mother for his sunburn. I believe things are set in motion that leads to that higher rate of mortality in childhood, and it plays itself out in adulthoods. This was the journal The Lancet. That's a British journal. They looked at what they call the United States of Health. They did academics and physicians at University of California, San Francisco, Harvard, and Cornell University, looked at healthcare inequality. And here are the conclusions. The life expectancies of the richest Americans, 10 to 15 years longer than those with lowest incomes. The 5% of Americans with the lowest incomes have seen essentially no gains in life expectancy since 2001, while middle and upper income Americans have gained 2 years. Now, you think about what's happened since 2001. We have a lot of new surgical techniques. We have a lot of new and very powerful medications. We have revolutionized the way we hospitalize people. We have laparoscopic surgery has become more common. We're using robotic surgery. We're doing all these things. And yet there have been no gains in life expectancy since 2001. Based on current trends, the gap in life expectancy between the 20% of the country's population with the lowest incomes and the 20% with the highest incomes will increase by nearly 10 years in a single generation. That is, they are widening rather dramatically. And one in 10,
But don't you think it's a little early? I mean, that's a 15-year span, but will we see an uptick that fast? This seems to me like it's a glacier, right? It's a little slower to form, a little slower to do. I mean, will we see? I mean, because again, they started in 2001, but they've obviously happened over the course of the last 15 or 16 years, with some of them being in the latter part of that. So, I mean, is it just too early to see the glacier?
Well, think about it, though, for a minute, Rick. I mean, we talked about the medications, but what else has happened since 2001? The Affordable Care Act has dropped our insurance, uninsured rates, to record low levels, and yet that didn't help. Well, and this is the frustrating thing to me, is that we have spent now, since 2008, we have spent our entire energies arguing about whether people should or shouldn't have insurance, whether the government should be involved in insurance or not insurance. Meanwhile, no change whatsoever in life expectancy for these people. Either the insurance doesn't buy the access they need, or it doesn't matter. But for one reason or another, we are not addressing the issues, the things that they need. And you look at this child abuse thing, and you look at the teenage thing, and you look at Rick's sunburn experience, and you realize these things are outside of a doctor's office. You can't fix these with insurance.
Well, but more importantly, right, they happen at an early stage in life. And again, what happened in 2001 is not going to be reflected until the kids that were born in 1995, 98 get to the end of life age.
Yeah. I'm just,
it's going to be hard to, it's going to be hard to translate.
But the direction things are headed now is entirely wrong.
Yeah.
You know, the separation in life expectancy, the separation in income, has never been greater.
Well, but I think there's also, I don't think we've seen anything. We've seen a meteoric rise in obesity rates, right? I mean, I think we've seen other trends that have just skyrocketed that are probably offsetting any good we're doing with modern medicine.
Agreed, and more in poor people.
Right.
And again, they've been targeted by fast food restaurants. They've been targeted by tobacco.
And sugar.
And so they have conditions. Now, either they're, as I said, they have access to medications. They have access to emergency care. Have access to apparently some forms of primary care, but that access is not changing health habits, lifestyle habits, in a way that is even slowing this down.
To take this a different direction for you, Tony, is there a chance that maybe we've increased access to care, but we've not actually increased the availability of care? In other words, more people can go to the doctor, but it's not like we turned out a whole bunch more doctors. There's still the same number of doctors seeing the same number of patients, and the rural areas were already pretty busy. Right? I mean, have we really created an environment that's actually, I mean, so yeah, maybe people can pay for it now, but that doesn't mean they're getting in regular.
Or they may have a policy that really doesn't pay for things. That's the other possibility. We see at the free clinic, Shelley and I are seeing people with just these monstrous deductibles. They cannot afford to pay for their care. And if they were involved in a huge car accident, their insurance would kick in. But the day-to-day stuff that is going to affect their life expectancy, that's all out of pocket.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted us to think kind of, first of all, admittedly, the child abuse is a bit of a stretch in explaining things. But you start to realize, first of all, if a few children die, it has a major effect on life expectancy. Basically, a six-month-old infant dies. That really does move the needle down as far as the life expectancy in that community.
In the sibling study, did they look at what they were dying from, the sibling that survived?
Yeah, and it was, as you might imagine, there were some higher rates of suicide, higher rates of self-harm. Possibly, again, it may be that they lived in that kind of household where one of their siblings died. They may have lived in a household where people lived dangerously. They didn't have a model of living safely, or it may have scarred them. You know, mm-hmm. it could be either way. But you're right. This was not necessarily dying of congenital heart disease or cancer or things like that. It was a lot of it was self-harm and complications of mental illness as much as complications of heart disease or so forth. Well, we've done it again. We've wasted our second fractional portion, but we've got one more shot to make this right. Tune in for our third fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Week with the Hospital and Hospitality Show. And now, as promised in the first fractional portion, I will read the amended apology from United Airlines.
And I'm not commenting this time because
that's right, because Rick has been outvoted. The this truly horrific event that occurred on this show has elicited many responses from all of us, particularly Rick. Outrage, anger, disappointment. I share those sentiments.
You know, I'm going to speak after you're done.
And one above all, my deepest apologies for what happened. Like you, I continue to be disturbed by what happened on this show. And I deeply apologize to the co-host, forcibly removed, and to our listeners. No one should ever be mistreated this way. I want you to know we take full responsibility for our show. We'll work to make it right. And it is never too late to do the right thing. We have committed to our customers and our employees. We're going to fix what's broken so this never happens again. This will include a thorough review of our studio booking, our policies for volunteer co-hosts in these situations, and how we handle oversold radio show seats, an examination of how we partner with security and local law enforcement. I promise you we will do better. So, things evolve. Especially when you your company is being boycotted.
And they got bad policy.
Yeah.
They should. They got bad policy. And, you know, the funny thing is I'm a Delta guy, so I can make fun of United all day long because I've been flying Delta for years. But Delta, I've never seen them stop at a limit. I mean, they just keep raising the ante, right?
Yeah.
So if they need a seat and they need to get somebody on the plane, they keep raising. They essentially buy their way out of the problem. And
that's, in fact, they have more bumps than any other airline, but they're voluntary bumps. They'll pay you.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten as much as 800 myself, and I'm usually one to not want a bump, right? So they've started off very high to get me to go, and I think you can always buy your. I mean, if the airlines is going to cramp the seats and they're going to figure out how to lower the number of routes, increase the number of people flying on every flight, and they're going to have these constant, you know, seat maneuverings going on, then they're going to have to be able to buy their way out of problems.
Our sponsor for the final time, Melanoma, Learn, Don't Burn, reminding you Kentucky ranks number 6 in the nation in melanoma mortality. We lose 136 Kentuckians every year to melanoma, many of them young, because it is a cancer that preferentially affects young people. We talked about last time the number of sunburns between 15 and 25 is the key thing. But we recommend that you try to avoid sunburns at any age. This is why I put this in as a sponsor. The journal, the American Medical Association Journal of Dermatology, in 2017, looked at beach umbrellas versus sunscreen. And what they found, both the umbrella and the sunscreen groups increased global sunburn scores compared with baseline. But the difference was greater for the umbrella group. They said redness in one or more sites developed in 78% of the umbrella group, 25% of the sunscreen group, grade 2 sunburns, 17 participants in the umbrella group, 2 in the sunscreen group. The problem with the umbrella, generally not big enough. And the other thing that they commented on is apparently you set up your umbrella to block reflected light as much as the direct sunlight. That is, if there happens to be a gleaming building, a piece of glass, white sand or something like that, you'll lean it that way in order to protect your eyes, really more than protect your skin. And there is also the fact that the sun does shift and you don't necessarily move your umbrella. But an umbrella is not equal to a sunscreen in terms of sun protection on the beach, is what they found, what these researchers found. So I thought we would pass that on, let you guys know that, as you make your summer plans. Rick, this one is for you.
Great.
Washington Post, April 13th. A self-funded team led by a Philadelphia area emergency room physician has won the International X Prize Tri-Quarter Consumer Medical Competition. Launched in 2012, ask applicants to build an affordable, lightweight health kit that can diagnose and interpret 13 health conditions and monitor 5 vital signs. The winning team, by the way, there were actually 4 brothers on the winning team. They beat out more than 300 competitors, won $2.6 million
in
prize
money. You said tricorder, right?
Yep.
So we're talking about a Star Trek device that they would wave over the patient and fix their stuff.
Not necessarily wave, but it had to be less than 5 pounds.
In the movies.
It had to be
portable. I'm saying in the movies.
Yeah. If you remember, Dr. McCoy would always wave it, and then he would go, "He's dead, Jim." The only thing I know that you can diagnose with a tricorder is death.
No. In Star Trek IV, where they go to San Francisco and they go back in time.
This is scary.
They use the tricorder to actually repair some kind of artery that fixes the lady's dialysis. So it can be done, Tony. It can. Just watch the movie.
I watched the TV show, and the only thing he diagnosed
on the TV
show was
death. I'm not old enough to have watched the TV show.
Well,
you caught it first run.
Yeah, I did. And hadn't thought about that in a long time, but thank you very much for that. Okay, so what this thing did, they called it Dexter. DX, which means it's an abbreviation for diagnosis, and T, and then a capital ER, which is like the emergency room. It learns to diagnose medical conditions by integrating learnings from clinical emergency medicine and data analysis from the patients. It has a device for testing blood, glucose, your blood counts, your white blood cell counts using a finger cuff instead of pricking your finger and getting an actual blood sample. 7 patents applied for the device. Now here, this is the kind of Washington Post, the kind of condescending attitude they have. Prior to last week's win, the Basil Harris, the emergency room physician that won the thing, his only previous invention was a cotton candy machine that he made in grade school. Did we need to know that from the Washington Post?
And is a cotton candy machine hard to make?
Well, were you making cotton candy machines in grade school? That's the thing. I mean, this is fair enough. It's an easy machine to make. All right, but you go back to fifth grade
blower.
Rick Phillips.
It's
and
a
see
motor.
If he can make a cotton candy machine. The second place was a team that started with 50 physicians, scientists, and programmers. They had a smartphone-controlled device. And then led by Harvard Medical School biomedical engineering guy. So this emergency room physician, it's actually a pretty good thing that he did. 5-pound device, monitors 5 vital signs, has the ability to monitor blood tests and so forth, and put a tentative diagnosis of, I believe I said, 15 different conditions.
So when I was in the Army, Tony.
13 conditions, yeah.
I actually built from a picture, right? I used a picture in a journal, a needle biopsy aspiration device, right? So you would take a regular syringe and put it in this device, and it would give the surgeon the ability to use the device with bigger hands, right?
So what you got there then, when he talks about aspiration, you poke the needle somewhere, you create a sudden suction that will draw tissue into
correct.
The needle, and you pull it out.
Correct.
And that's a needle biopsy aspiration device.
I actually built one and actually got an Army Commendation Medal for building one.
You still have the medal?
Probably. You can buy it at any store. I mean, Army Commendation Medals are not, very, they're not, I wouldn't say they are uncommon, but, obviously they're not easy to get. Interesting, yeah. I did. I actually built one in like 1987 or 88, something like that, as one of my first years as a biomedical guy. And so yes. I did build more than a cotton candy machine.
We should enter that contest next year.
The tricorder contest?
Yeah.
I have not invented anything.
I haven't either.
You invented a perfectly good radio show.
I ruined a perfectly good radio show.
I didn't say that. I didn't say you didn't ruin it. I just said you invented it.
Well, but I thought you would like the tricorder. And
I do. I think it's cool. I think, the question is will we see a real kind of tricorder type device that uses some type of ultrasound waves or, something to actually do some of this without the mechanics by which we do our normal testing today. It'll be interesting to see if it happens in our lifetime. I doubt it will, but you never know.
Really? You think it won't?
Well, I don't know if we have the ability to do beam direction and power generation to be able to do something like a gamma knife type thing from something that'll fit in my hand, right? I don't know. It's going to take a while before we get to that level of miniaturization and accuracy that, you know, we'll be able to put in a doctor's office.
Well, you know, we've talked on the show numerous times. Pretty much everybody in medical research wants to stick a chip or some type of monitoring device inside you.
Yeah, but
allow it to communicate with...
Monitoring's different. I think that will happen in our lifetime. Again, we have the ability to look at electrical signals. We have the ability to look at chemical levels. We can do all that with an implantable or something like that. But to actually take a formed beam of RF and cut or mend or repair in a closed or a... gosh, what's the term? I've been out of healthcare for too long. What's the term I'm looking for? A non-invasive way...
Right.
I think that's going to be much harder to accomplish.
Well, when Bones first had the tricorder, like I said, it didn't do squat. Apparently, later versions that some of the more modern Star Trekkers used actually did something besides diagnosing death. But what you would do, you'd have this 5-pound thing. It would check your white blood cell count level, and maybe it's elevated, indicating a possible infection. It would look at your temperature. It would look at how fast you were breathing. And if you had an elevated white blood cell count, you had an elevated temperature, you were breathing fast, it would say you probably got a pneumonia. And so that'd be one condition. Now we only have 12 more to go. So this, you can see, first of all, this would be really good if you were exploring, if you were on a space flight, something like that. Hook yourself up and do some self-diagnosis. It might be at a kiosk in the mall. You know, let's face it, if we can tell your future, then we could probably figure out whether or not you've got pneumonia. Lost you, didn't I?
No, it's the... I was going to resort to the genetic testing, which we can do that, you know, with the genetic testing.
Yeah, and will be a probability.
We'll already know that data. Your tricorder will be outdated before...
Right, I think I think of something that you take, camping, wilderness exploration, space travel, things like that, where you're going to be away from a doctor.
Yeah, but the tricorder only belonged... I mean, what kind of Star Trek guy are you? Only the doctor had one. It's an approved medical device, Tony.
But he used it when he was outside of his medical office.
I never once remember him being in the medical office.
That's a good point.
The tricorder was his office.
Maybe we'll revolutionize medicine, but I doubt it. Got enough time for a couple of things.
Yeah, three or four the way you go.
Yeah. Well, I have been a little bit, I have to say it. No, I've been... a little bit attention deficit.
Well, and you'll do anything to keep me from talking. I get it.
Well, I worry about the show's ratings once you get on one of your rants.
They can't go down.
One of them is going to get tired of us. One of them is going to get tired of us, and that's it.
No, they need filler.
Okay. I'm just saying. Nation's first soda tax fulfilling health experts' goals, according to Reuters Health. This is in Berkeley, California. They put a 1 penny per ounce sugary drink tax. A home run, says Dr. Lynn Silver, senior advisor at Public Health Institute in Oakland. Since March 2015, residents drank less sugary drinks, more water, more milk, more healthy beverages. Average consumer grocery bills did not rise. Local store revenue did not fall. And the tax raised money for health education programs. I mean, it is win, win, win. They simply shifted their purchases to healthier drinks when you put a 1 penny per ounce soda tax. We talked about this before in Mexico because they have such high rates of diabetes and high rates of sugary beverage consumption. And now it's worked in Berkeley. And the problem is, you know, here in Appalachia, we have the nation's highest soft drink consumption rates. So it's right there. Now we know what works. If we want to attack this problem, if we want to attack our obesity problem, and if we want to get our people to make it to nudge them in a direction that would be healthier, we know exactly what we got to do.
How do you combat that? I mean, a tax isn't going to solve everything, especially a penny. It's going to have to be bigger than that.
Yeah, but that's probably, 75 cents on a 2-liter?
Yeah, it does add up, Rick. But the other thing is, regardless of how much it is, the consumption dropped 10%.
In Kentucky, we need to drop 80%.
We do. But I would settle for 10. I would be glad for 10. To see, you know, when you see children, I mean, young children with Mountain Dew.
Well, so the thing I guess I'd like to talk about on a future show is does that include diet sugary drinks? Because there still seems to be some confusion when I talk to folks about that. I mean, I think, you know, they still, you know, does it actually raise your insulin levels? Does your body still think it's just like a regular sugary drink? Is it really going to have the same impact on the society? I don't know. I'd love to know, but I think you're going to see a lot of people are going to go to. You're going to probably need to tax both of them.
Well, I will tell you, right now the research indicates that diet drinks are really bad for your health. The problem is that research is looking at people who drink diet drinks and asking what happens to them. It's called observational research, and that's the whole problem. People who drink diet drinks are already concerned about their health. That's why they're drinking the diet drinks. They tend to be overweight. They tend to be in worse health, and so they pick up the diet drinks. So, in fact, are we seeing just the fact that sicker people drink diet drinks? Are we seeing that diet drinks make people sicker? And we can't tell yet. And frankly, I just saw a couple of papers on this, higher rates of stroke, and I think higher mortality rates with the sugar-free drinks. But both those studies had that same flaw. They watched people to see what they drank and what happened without thinking about why they drank the diet drink in the first place. So the confusion's there, Rick. You're absolutely right. But it won't be solved anytime soon with the type of studies we're doing now. There's a possible way that diet drinks could cause problems. But whether or not they actually do, who knows? Along the same lines, New York City mayor looks to raise cigarette prices to $13 a pack. They are going to raise their tax on cigarettes per pack from $4.35 up to $6.85. New York's rate of lung cancer per 100,000 is 61. Kentucky's rate of lung cancer per 100,000 is 96. Our cigarette tax, 60 cents. They're raising to $6.85. We're stuck at 60 with a death rate from lung cancer that's 30% higher than theirs.
And that's pretty much how we're going to have to end because, I mean, what can you say? How can you defend it at all?
I just think intelligent taxation, making it easier to do the right thing and the healthy thing, could really pay off for each and every time.
But you know, Tony, the one thing that I will say, and while I am absolutely not defending this at all, I think Kentucky has just moved from being, you know, my time here in the last 20 years, you know, we went from being primarily a tobacco generation state to you drive down the road now, you don't see it as much. Right? I mean, I do think Kentucky has moved away from it as an agricultural cash crop. And I think that in itself will slowly erode that love of the less tax, more cigarettes.
Maybe so. Can you symbolically move us away from being on the air?
Sure, I can drag you out of here. Special thanks to substitute board operator and occasionally the station manager, Paul Bluesman Hitchcock, and our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org, or just visit us on Facebook, do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
Health Matters is a prescription radio show used in adults to prevent and treat gout.
Health Matters can cause serious side effects or death if levels of the show are too high in your body. Listening on certain radios can cause your level of Health Matters to be too high, even at recommended doses, especially if you have kidney or liver problem.
Tell your healthcare provider about all your medical conditions and all the medicines you take, including prescription and non-prescription medicines, vitamins, and herbal supplements, and if you consume grapefruit juice, which you know I don't like.
Tell your healthcare provider if you have any side effect that bothers you or doesn't go away.
The most common side effects in people who have gout flares are diarrhea and throat pain.
Whatever you do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week. Make a healthy change in your life. Listen to Paul's Saturday night show, Nothing But the Blues, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.